good. Dan Campbell has joined us this morning, and we'll be talking about some of the history that Dan has lived or remembers. We'll also be talking as the week goes on, by the way, with lots of other guests. And, of course, as usual, anybody that wants to pop in and join us or just observe or eavesdrop is certainly invited to do so here at the Crockery. Tomorrow, we'll be talking with Errol Andrew, and we'll be looking over some old Lindsley pictures. Lawrence Lindsley was a photographer in our area who did a marvelous job of chronicling with photographs some of this area's history, some great pictures of the early days of the town site of Chelan, also some wonderful pictures of the lake itself. By the way, the folks at Chelan Photographics are one of our heritage sponsors this year and would like to let folks know that the entire two books of Lindsley pictures are available at the Chelan Photographics office in downtown Chelan. You can stop in and take a look at them, and if you would like prints, you can have prints made. I have seen Errol work on these things, and he has one print, for instance, that he has made up already for someone, maybe for himself, of the Field Hotel that would almost take up a wall. It's a marvelous picture, and if you're interested in the history of the area, I'd strongly suggest that you stop in at Chelan Photographics and talk with Errol about the pricing and so on. Or come by tomorrow when the books will be here and you can look through some of them, and we'll be talking about the Lindsley pictures as well. But this morning, our guest is, as we mentioned, Dan Campbell of Campbell's Hotel. Dan, want to thank you for joining us this morning. Appreciate you coming by.
Scott Brundage, good morning, and thank you.
And I know you just got your role there, but we're going to have to put that in abeyance until our next commercial break.
All right.
Dan, your family has been in the Chelan area since when?
1890? Scott, my grandfather came out here in 89. He was a young attorney from Sioux City, Iowa. And he'd had enough of the cold winters, and he was moving westward. And when he got to Portland, he had heard about the Chelan area. And I believe he walked in from the Coulee City end of the railroad and found, the story is he found about 1,000 miners here that were getting ready to prospect the Cascades, and it looked like a very attractive place to get his roots down and make his fortune.
Yeah. So when he came here, now the hotel as we know it now wasn't built until the turn of the century, was it?
And that's right. It was built in 1901.
But wasn't he one of the first major permanent houses built by him?
Yes,
in the valley?
He built what in those times was rather a nice home where John Snyder lives now, right across from the school. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother was quite a cook, and it developed into a stage stop. Of course, the rooms there were very limited, and the Teamsters and the bus people would sleep under their wagons, and it was conceived, they conceived the idea that they could go into a more elaborate hotel business. Mm-hmm.
But for about the first 10 years, it was sort of a modified hotel, wasn't it?
That's right. It was a big home with a garden in back and the cows and the big kitchen.
When your grandfather decided to build the Campbell's Hotel, when was that, 1900, 1901, somewhere in there?
He had a brother-in-law named Amos Edmonds, who incidentally was the first mayor of Chelan. And Amos was a substantial farmer in Illinois, and when he came out to visit, he was so impressed with the area that he arranged to loan my grandfather $10,000 to build the original Campbell Hotel. My grandfather and Amos Edmonds had married sisters. And Amos also settled in Chelan.
It's hard to fathom, I think, and especially in today's economy, looking at a building like yours, as it stands now, it's pretty much the same shell, and think that you could build that for $10,000.
Well, the story is that carpenters were paid 35 cents an hour, and during the construction of it, they got a 10 cent an hour wage, which I think taxed the budget pretty severely.
Yeah, yeah. There's more. there's more to that. I think it was on one of your menus once. I read a short story about the reaction of the fellow who sold C.C. Campbell the land that thing was built on, or something like that.
Scott, really, I think there's a lot of poetic license in that. It just kind of made a good story, but he had sold that, the first parcel of the sand dune, to my grandfather for $200, and the story was that he went into the saloon and said he'd sold the sand dune to a sucker, and he wanted to buy drinks for the house.
I see. But you're not sure about the accuracy of that.
Well, this being 80, some 80 years later, we prefer to think there's some truth in it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Now, there was more. Amos Edmonds came and loaned your grandfather the money, but didn't they also import some other people to work on the design of the hotel or something? Weren't they looking for an architect or something?
As I said, my grandfather was a young attorney in Sioux City, Iowa, and he was involved in politics, and he was elected magistrate, and his police chief was a man named Cox, and they became very good friends. Cox was an Englishman with quite an architectural background.
I see.
And he was a builder and an architect, and my grandfather persuaded him to join him in Chelan. He not only built the original Camel Hotel, he built a tremendous auditorium, which has since burned, which is located, as we can see out the window right here, where the city hall, the library, and the fire department are located. And he also built the log church from sketches that this famous New York architect had mailed.
I see. So the pavilion you're talking about is the one that burned in the big fire in 27.
The auditorium.
The auditorium, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The big fire, right.
I recently saw a picture, a Bill Gurr photo, of a pavilion on the lake itself, and it looked to me as though it might have been very close to where the Campbell Hotel is.
There were at least three pavilions. One was torn down when they raised the lake in 1926. Mm-hmm. Walter Irons leased some property from us and built another pavilion. It burned, and the third pavilion was torn down to make room for our number two lodge next to Cannon's.
I see.
Big dance floors.
Yeah. Do you remember, were these in existence at the same time as each other, or were they?
No. One anteceded the other.
Okay. We're talking with Dan Campbell this morning, and as we mentioned, if you'd like to stop by and join us or eavesdrop or whatever, you're welcome to do it. We're at the Crockery live, and we will be every day through the month of March, but we'll take a commercial break right now.
Maybe too far back, Dr. Irene, my sunglasses and canvas down.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'd forgotten that Amos Edmonds and your father or grandfather were related by marriage. I knew it before, but I'd forgotten it.
You know, I think that they were, I'm not just saying it, I think they were really strong.
They had to be, you know, because they weren't. Just between you and I, between the two of them, they effectively changed the logical site of the town from Lakeside to Chelan.
They did, for fact.
Great. They had to be pretty sharp. Here we go again.
Thank you, Steve. Dan, this is kind of out of left field, I know, but maybe I'll get lucky here. What I was wondering is, when Amos Edmonds became mayor of the town, as I have been able to find, one of the things that he talked about in his first campaign, if you will, was in finding a way to get navigation down to this end of Lake Chelan. Have you ever seen any pictures around of any dredging that was done at this end of Lake Chelan or anything like that, or any written letters that have survived from that?
Scott, of course, you're really taking me back before my time. I never knew Amos Edmonds. He died in the early 20s. It was a river between the Caravel and Camel's Lodge. Mm-hmm. And as I understand the stories, it was the natural ford for cattle movement up to the Okanagan. It was the only shallow place in the river.
Mm.
It was so shallow that when they attempted to bring steamboats down to the dock by the bridge, they would, at first they would bring the steamboats down backwards, so the action of the big screw in the sand would make the channel deeper. And they used to work on this weeks at a time to deepen the channels to provide space for the boat to get down to, because at that time they couldn't get any farther down than Lakeside.
I know that after that there were, I think maybe even starting in the 1890s, there was a series of attempts at damming the river, which most of which failed. And
yes, there was. There was. They raised the lake 1 foot, and you can still see the remains of the old dam below the bridge. You can see it quite clearly now. That dam was, I understand, was taken out in the flood of 98, a tremendous high water of 98. It was very, very competitive between Lakeside and Chelan. Lakeside was really the community. That's where the hotel was. That's where the boats docked. They had their own city. There was more than one boat company on the lake, and they were just really working hard for business.
Yeah. When you talk about under the bridge, you're talking about the old bridge? Oh, the bridge at your place?
The present old bridge by our hotel. If you look below it on a clear day, you can see perhaps 100, 150 feet down the remains of the original dam. Some of the boards and the piling are still in place.
I'm going to have to go and take a look at that one of these days. Yeah.
It's there.
Dan, as I've gone through the old newspaper records, for instance, of course, there's for those who haven't seen the article that you prepared for the Historical Society's Historical Notes here a couple of years ago, going into the library and looking at the old newspapers in the period of the turn of the century can tell a lot also about the day-by-day progress of the construction of the hotel, which is kind of interesting to read sometimes. They had a big opening for that thing, didn't they? Do you remember that? Or,
well, I remember.
Obviously, you weren't there.
No,
but
in 1901. I understand that Waterville was a real significant community, and those wheat farmers all would gravitate to the lake for obvious reasons during the summer. Mm-hmm. And on this June date, they apparently had just an old-fashioned housewarming, literally a few hundred people, food, dancing, until 4 o'clock in the morning. We think now if somebody stays up to a party at 4 o'clock in the morning, why, that's pretty late, but yeah. They used to do it then.
I do that once a year, and I still get in trouble for it. I can remember in the paper, I think they published a partial list of those who were present even, and it was a voluminous amount of people. Do you remember C.C. Campbell?
Oh, my grandfather? Well? Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, indeed. He died when he was 88, about 1936. He was a very imposing man. He had a very strong personality. And, of course, being a small boy, he had the kind of approach that if he said jump, all I would ask was how far.
Yeah.
We had a good relationship.
What kind of things did he enjoy doing with his grandkids?
Well, Grandfather was always interested in business, and it was kind of a shame that the latter part of his years was during the depth of the Depression. Mm-hmm. And that sort of an existence consumed everybody's full time just to to beat the wilderness away from your back door and to exist. So my recollections of my grandfather during his latter years are recollections of Depression times.
Mm-hmm. Did he work, you know, well into his 80s? Was he a the reason I ask you that is what little I can glean about him from reading, you know, the locally available sources is that he was a tremendous activist. I know he got involved in politics. He got involved in his community government and in his business and so on. Did he remain an activist, as you recall?
No, he didn't. He used to have a lot of his old friends down, and they would play rummy, and they would sit in the old hotel lobby. I remember Ben Smith. I can just kind of hazily picture these men meeting twice a week for their afternoon social card game and visits about old times. My, how I wish I'd paid more attention to what they said and the things that they talked about.
It's the old thing, I wish I had a tape recorder, yeah. Talking with Dan Campbell this morning, live from the Crockery, and we're going to take another commercial break and rejoin you in a moment. Thank you very much, Steve. Talking, as you mentioned, with Dan Campbell this morning about some of the area's local history. Dan was kind enough to come and join us this morning. Tomorrow we'll be looking over some Lindsley pictures. On Thursday, by the way, we'll be talking to a couple of guys who are very interesting, and one whom I hope will be able to tell us more about the earliest attempts to dam the Chelan River. That would be Jim Huffman from the Chelan County PUD. Some time ago, Jim, in working on the Exhibit R for the relicensing of the local project, had to go into some of the local history himself and came up with some marvelous stories. I hope he can remember them all. And also Ralph Kurtz from the PUD will be with him, and they will be talking about this area before the Indian, even, and how it was formed and such. So that should be interesting. But today, of course, we're talking about it when there were people here, and lots of them. Dan, you mentioned the Depression years when things got pretty tough. I would imagine that for a business such as the one that your family owned, it got probably particularly tough, huh?
Chelan has really been primarily an agricultural community, and even in the 20s, the money that was generated here was apple money. Big money was made in the late 20s before the Depression. Lots of apple plantings. Prices were good. Small fortunes were made. And then everybody fell off the end of the cliff. Everybody in business, it seemed to me, had an apple orchard of various sizes, had their own packing sheds. Apple prices were terribly depressed for 5 or 6 years. Farmers walked away from their land. The county would have to send bulldozers in to push out the trees. Notes weren't paid. The mortgages were overdue. There wasn't any travel. There wasn't any tourist business. People had cows, they had gardens. It was a very, very distressing time. I remember my father lost all of his orchards, and he went bankrupt. The reason we didn't lose the hotel property was that it was still in his father's name. So the family all lived down the old hotel. My brother and I lived in rooms there. We had a big kitchen. We had a fine dining table. Like somebody has libraries, we had a farm, garden, pigs, the works.
Yeah.
Those were grim years, Scott.
Yeah, I'm sure they were. You mentioned your father. It's, you know, in the when you got into the when did he begin to get into the operation of the hotel business?
He came out of the university of Washington probably about 1916 and spent probably 2 years in the army, quite a lot of that in France, and then when he came back, he got involved in the hotel business with his father.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gravitated off into the apple business, as so many other people did.
Yeah,
they were bringing water into the Manson deal then. Prices were good.
That was P.A. Campbell, right?
My father was A.C. Campbell.
A.C. Campbell, right. Okay, right.
Arthur.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
Same name as my brother.
Yeah, yeah. How about your mother? Where did she come from?
And, she was a... She was a Iowa school teacher that came out to teach school in Chelan and got off the Columbia River ferry in the vicinity of Aswell. And I believe she lived her first year here in the old Whaley home, mm-hmm. where a lot of the school teachers lived.
Yeah.
Where the Addises live now.
So they met locally then?
They met locally.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just flashed on something. I don't know if you'll remember it either. One story that I remember from about 1909 or so was it was probably the last time anybody rode through town on horseback with six guns that C.C. Campbell was involved in. And well, I'll tell you one then. How's that? Because I think I can remember it now. A bunch of high school students it was. They were celebrating the rites of spring in June, whatever. And they rode through town on horseback shooting up the place with their six guns. And to me, it speaks to a difference in the times is the reason it's an interesting story, because the judge was C.C. Campbell. And these boys were rounded up, or many of them were. And in the article in the paper, Judge Campbell recognized that there was not solid proof of the identity of each of those boys in legal terms, but there was proof of a couple. So what he did was to sit down with them in private and sternly warn them never to do it again, and tell them, you know, fellas, that just isn't the way things are done, and that was it. They got off, but on the other hand, they never rode down the street shooting off their six guns again.
Well, I'm sure your observation that he could be stern was correct, because I can remember that. He was a big man, he was strong physically, and he had a strong personality. He used to always be the center of attention at annual functions where the community would get together and make speeches on whatever they used to call Founders Day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the 1930s, you were involved in the school system here then, weren't you? You would have been going to school.
Yes, I went to high school. I graduated from high school in 1940.
Oh, that's one thing. Let me back up here a little bit. Your father, he went to school here in the 19-teens.
Well, he graduated from high school with the first class in 1908 with a class of four.
Sure, I've seen a picture of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Howard Van Slyke. Just a little.
Do you remember him ever talking? Thank you, Denise. Do you remember him ever talking about the social activities that they had going in high school? Did they play baseball and football in 1907 and 8?
I think baseball at that time was the most important thing that a young man in the community could get involved in. The competition in reading these old newspaper articles and having talked with them was tremendously competitive, and they would have town teams and Waterville and Wenatchee and the Okanagan. They would have literally a 3-day 4th of July festival. Some of these town teams would hire semi-pro pitchers. There were bets on them. It was highly competitive, and of course my father was quite an athlete.
That explains why in some of the old papers you'll see the names of the town team rosters. The names are familiar from other articles in the paper, you know, marriages and such, but there's always one or two in there that are strange entirely. That must have been the out-of-town pitchers.
Yeah. Kind of a humorous anecdote, see if I can pick the threads of it out, that Amos Edmonds told me. He said he could never make the team. He wasn't good enough. But he was so enamored with the sport of baseball that for 10 cents he wrote and obtained a book on how to play baseball. And he can still remember this priceless gem of advice that said in the book, when playing the outfield against a heavy hitter, play deep. He said he thought he got his 10 cents worth.
Well, how about in your school days, in your brother Art's, did you Did you guys get involved in local athletics and such?
Well, Art was quite a basketball player and quite a swimmer. He swam on the Washington State swimming team. And during the war years when he was going to college, he played on some college basketball teams.
We'll have to get him in here and talk about that one of these days. Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm just skipping all over the place here. There were so many things that I wanted to talk with you about, and one of them I wanted to be sure to mention was the dawning of the 40s and the onslaught of World War II. I know that that as in every area, World War II brought about, or should we say, finished off the end of the Depression, and business-wise, things began to pick up again. But in your case, you went into the military, didn't you?
It's kind of interesting that you should bring that up. The high school classes that graduated from Chelan in 38, 39, 40, and 41, there was quite a mortality rate. When you look through the old Chelan annuals, there are a number of boys in my class that were killed in World War II. Some of the boys were captured in the Philippines. It was another bad time.
Yeah. One thing that struck me was in the Chelan Mirror, beginning shortly after the outbreak of the war, they began to publish a list of names of the young men who were in service. And I think the first list had something like 300 people on it. But not too long at all after the war began, I painstakingly one time counted the names that were listed, and there were over 800 by the end of 42 and 1943. Now, that had to be a tremendous percentage of the population of this community.
I really think it must have been a tremendous drain. It was true of all your other little agricultural communities throughout the valley, the Okanagan, the Wenatchee. Gosh, that seems like it was 100 years ago.
Yeah. What did you do in the war, Daddy?
What did I do?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I was no war hero. I was a pilot in the old Army Air Force. I went through my flying training in the desert of California and Arizona and Texas. I was a medium bomber pilot. I spent a year and a half flying in the Aleutian Islands off Alaska in 1943 and 1944 with some limited combat exposure. The weather was pretty bad. We had to learn to fly instruments pretty carefully.
Okay. You were flying medium-range bombers.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And for those in the audience who are as young as I recently, when I knew that I was going to bring you on, I looked up some old magazine articles I have with maps in it to tell me where the Aleutian Islands were. And they're a chain off of Alaska, which stretches really an awfully long ways toward Japan in a sort of an arc. And perhaps the younger folks in our audience will remember dimly a name like Dutch Harbor. Dutch Harbor was in the Aleutian Islands and so on. And they were considered, you correct me if I'm wrong here because you were around then, but they were considered by the United States to be of major strategic importance because they represented a set of stepping stones, if you could look at it that way, from the Japanese mainland to the American mainland in the Alaskan Territory. And in the Great Battle of Midway, there was a diversionary force from the Japanese that instituted an attack on the Aleutian Islands, hoping to draw some of our naval forces off and so on. There was some fairly major action in that area. But what would you be doing flying a bombing aircraft in the Aleutians?
Scott, there was a very small air force in Alaska called the 11th Air Force. And I arrived early in 43. Kiska had just been secured. The Japanese had, of course, occupied it. And they'd finally taken their men off in submarines. They were also on AT-2. We developed a quite a sophisticated air base on Attu, and our squadron was located there for a year, and we would make low-level flights from Attu to the Northern Kurils, which is which Russia now has since the end of the war. Our purpose was to drive the Japanese fishing fleet off the seas and to now and then strafe their runways because they had built up their air power there. But mostly it was to secure the North Pacific as from invasion. Mm-hmm. It was mostly a defensive and holding position.
Were most of your flights assigned bombing runs to a specific area? Or
yeah, these were twin-engine low-level flights. Usually flew under the fog. I can remember it was 750 miles one way from Attu to Paramushiro. A bombing flight would take 8 to 10 hours. Half of your bomb bay was filled full of gasoline because you didn't have enough capacity in the wing tanks. And lots of times your missions were aborted because of weather, and which were the best flights.
I can understand.
And I was always a little disappointed to get over there and have the weather clear up, and you had to pursue your assignment.
Yeah, yeah.
You were a long ways from home.
In the islands that you were assigned to make attacks on, was there much Japanese resistance there?
Yes, they had some squadrons of Zeros, and they would come up and attack our formations.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the airplane you flew.
Well, the old B-25, they call it the Billy Mitchell. It was the same airplane that General Doolittle used when he took off from the carrier to bomb Tokyo the first time, and they were supposed to land them in China, and all of them crashed. They never made it because of the weather.
Yeah.
We had a crew of about four or five, a couple of gunners, a radio operator, a co-pilot.
Mm-hmm. And how effective could you be? Well, obviously you're flying the airplane, so I guess how effective could your gunners be from that airplane if you in the event where you were under attack by fighter planes? Did you kind of feel like a sitting duck?
There was a technique to it. Your best defensive position, and the planes are really designed for low-level flights, and mm-hmm. so you flew right on the surface of the water, so that you weren't exposed for your soft underbelly, and you had good turret guns, and you had good tail guns, and also the pilot fired forward-firing machine guns, too. You had an eye scope, just like a fighter plane. Of course, you weren't nearly as maneuverable as a fighter plane.
Yeah.
For strafing missions and for... it was kind of like a big flying tank.
Yeah.
You had a lot of armor plate.
It was 750 miles one way.
Right.
And you're flying on the surface of the water, what, maybe 100 feet, something like that?
Usually, going over 100, 200 feet.
At an airspeed of 150 miles an hour, maybe?
Yeah, ordinarily about 175. You cruise real slowly for economical gas consumption.
Geez, Dan, didn't you get tired?
Yeah, I got tired, but I can remember mostly getting scared.
Yeah, yeah. That would take all the daylight hours in a day to fly to where you were going.
No, you'd take off before dawn.
Yeah.
And you'd fly your first half your mission in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
I was a flight leader, and I'd have, later on, I had 4 to 8 planes in my flight. You'd fly in a little diamond shape. Arrange. Now you're taking me back so far. I'd forgotten a lot of this. A lot of this I haven't thought about in years.
Well, when we had Bob Vogler on a while ago, I hadn't been aware that Bob was a veteran of World War I, and he talked about crawling out on the wings of aircraft to tamper with the engines in flight.
He had a son. Do you know that he had a son that was a pilot that was killed in Japan?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's been so many boys from Shoah.
talking with Dan Campbell this morning, and we're going to take a bit of a break here. One thing I do want to mention is that the folks at Nutley Jewelers have got waiting for you a lot of things that will pertain to your family's heritage in the future. You know, Dan and I were talking earlier about sometimes you wish you'd had a tape recorder. Sometimes you wish you'd saved things. And at Nutley Jewelers, if you stop in there today or any day, you're going to find that Daryl and Marion can show you some wonderful things, cut glass, and when it's gift-giving time, the types of watches and jewelry that the recipient of your gift is going to treasure for a long, long time. It's a good place to get things at a very reasonable price that can become a part of your family's heritage. So I'd suggest that you stop in there and see Daryl and Marion Nutley. We're going to take a break from the crockery and come back in just a moment. Thank you, Steve. Speaking this morning with Dan Campbell and pulling out some old memories of days gone by. Dan, I have noticed in talking with you this morning and in sometimes in other conversations that we have too, that you seem to be an individual who really likes the past, likes to contemplate history. Does that accurately describe you?
Oh, I think we all like to identify with our heritage, particularly the positive side of it, and mm-hmm. our relationship with the community and the people and your people.
You know, you mentioned that the Depression was tough times, and I can remember sitting in my father's kitchen, and that wasn't all that long ago, and him talking about the Depression, and sometimes I'd say, oh my goodness, here comes another Depression story. But it's strange, I remember most of them. But the stories that I remember are those that he told of Depression times, that friendships that developed, unusual things that happened, a closeness that occurred in his community, which was also in Washington, that seemed to leave him feeling a little bit warm. What kind of things did you maybe go through that would be some of the fonder memories you have of that particular tough era?
Gosh, Scott, you don't really think about it as being tough because everybody had the same problems, and it's all kind of relative. There was plenty of useful, fruitful things to keep young men and girls busy. You didn't travel a lot, you didn't have any money to spend, but that didn't mean anything because nobody else did either. I think the real significant thing that started the community rolling again was the advent of the development of the Holden Mine and the bringing in of the New York money for its development, and the engineers that stayed in town, the offices they had here to do their basic engineering, the construction of the barges, the tug, and later on the transportation of the ore. It was the first thing that gave a little fresh economic breath of life to the community. Mm-hmm. Some fresh money in here.
Yeah. Do you remember, let's see, and looking through the papers of the 30s, see, I probably have it on you because I've looked these things over probably more recently than you have, but I can remember that the Harlem Globetrotters came here.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
Did you see them? Did
you? Oh, my, yes. And the better high school athletes would play a game with them up in their gym. Mm-hmm. I remember the Harlem Globetrotters stayed in the old Camel Hotel. Great, big, nice-looking men.
That would have been when Goose Tatum, I think, was the
right,
was one of their big headliners.
Right.
Yeah,
and others before him.
Yeah. Now, when the Globetrotters would come to town, which I think was probably at least two or three times, did that create a lot of excitement in the community that they were coming, or were they not
was,
the same as then as
sure.
now?
Sure. Yeah, I think that our opportunities for recreation are probably a lot more varied and sophisticated now, and those sort of events in the winter were a lot of fun. And they packed the people in.
Tell me, did they do the same kind of tricks that they do now?
Just the same.
The act hasn't changed.
Not a trick. It was very entertaining. It was a show.
Yeah. Another thing that I remember from the 30s, and sometime during this month we'll have a more full feature on it, was the great contest of 1935, when they had the young ladies of the community competing for a trip to Hollywood, had to go around to the stores, and I think every purchase was worth 100 votes, every $1 or something like that. Do you remember anything about that?
No, but I do remember there were an awful lot of very attractive, pretty girls in the valley, so it was an idea that was well worth while.
Well, you were at the stage of life then when you probably noticed that.
I was.
Talking with Dan Campbell this morning about memories of things gone by. Dan, when it came to using the lake and its as a natural resource for recreation, at the time when you were growing up, did area families have much opportunity to do that? Did you get to go up to Stehekin in the family boat and that kind of thing as we do now?
Oh, God, not on a very, very limited basis. Mm-hmm. Stehekin was a long ways away. The few boats that were on the lake were, in those days, were expensive. It was quite an event to go to Stehekin.
Yeah.
Very little boating.
Okay. How about, I'll come back and talk about that in a moment. I think we better take another quick break here and then we'll come back.
Do you have the guest books that go clear back?
Sorry, I don't know where they are. They were gone when I came home. Late 40s. They may be in somebody's attic down there.
I wonder, as a... Let's see, Elizabeth Taylor stayed there, right?
It was during the war years. I never saw her.
Oh, is that right? Were there other people of note who stayed
not
there?
Not really significant of the Korean General.
General Lee?
Ridgway. You know, in the early times, it was quite a gathering place for governors and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I wasn't involved in that. You should get to this movie.
I don't know if I do or not.
He told me about the horse races he used to have on Wooden Avenue before this cave.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Huh. That'd be it.
Yeah. Dogs would come out and bark, get tangled up in the horse's feet.
Yeah.
Thank you, Steve. Got kind of a dull overcast out there this morning. Got a good crowd of folks in here at the Crockery this morning, and we'd like to remind our listeners again that if you want to stop in and eavesdrop a little bit or come in and join us, maybe you got a question for one of the folks that's sitting with us that I haven't thought of, why stop in and join us. We'd like to have you. Dan, I'd like to return for a moment to some of your experiences during World War II. Now, you mentioned, you know, we've already talked about you flying the airplanes. Where were you? Where was your home base when you were in the Alaskan area? What was it like?
Well, my home base for a year was on the island of Attu, which is the extreme westernmost island of about 1,500 miles from Anchorage. We used to come back to Anchorage occasionally for instrument proficiency checks and to get updated new equipment.
Now, when
a little R&R.
Did you, when you went in, from what I've read about aviation had to grow up fast in World War II. It hadn't when it started. It had to grow up kind of fast. And frankly, I'm wondering how anybody in his right mind could look at an airplane and say, yeah, I want to fly that thing. Was that your choice, or did they tell you you had to do that?
There was an incredible number of young men who just were so motivated to learn to fly that it's hard to describe it now. It was just simply this thing to do. You almost might characterize it as almost a rheumatic syndrome to be a pilot.
Yeah.
Especially if you could be a fighter pilot. You know, wear the goggles and the romance of it all.
In today's vernacular, they might call it macho or something.
Yes, I'm sure there's some of that in it.
Yeah.
It was exciting. It was exciting times.
If you could, tell me about how long it took you. You went through, what, basic training for 13 weeks, something like that in those days?
Oh, yes. It takes you almost a year to go through pilot training.
Okay.
And
then
crew training and combat training.
They took that much time to train the pilots, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the very first time that you took over the controls of an airplane?
No, I don't think a person will ever forget that.
Yeah.
The first time he ever soloed a military aircraft.
Yeah. Where were you training when you did that?
Well, interesting that you should ask. There's a little country town in Arizona called Scottsdale, which is really a sophisticated city now, but at the time I learned to fly at Thunderbird Airfield, it was a little town about the size of Antioch, with cotton and citrus groves and a few service stations. You had to hitchhike 20 miles to get to downtown Phoenix.
Is that right? What kind of physical facility was it? Was it like we look at an airport now?
It was a brand new little field. They just scraped out a flat spot in the desert, a big dirt runway, and thrown up a hangar to repair the airplanes and do their maintenance, and a bunch of small prefab apartments that were thrown up for housing. Big kitchen for the kids. You ate a lot of salt tablets because you sweat a lot in June in Arizona.
I imagine you did, yeah. What kind of airplane was it that you were training in?
Oh, it's the old-fashioned Stearman. You still see that type of bi-wing airplane spraying orchards and farmland.
Mm-hmm. Double winger, huh?
Oh, yeah. It was kind of an interesting airplane that had its gas tanks on the top wing, so that if you were to do a slow roll and fly on your back, the engine would quit. The gas was gravity to get to the motor.
Yeah.
So, but when you turned it back over, the air was turning the propeller, and your motor would start again. So it was kind of exhilarating the first time you flew on your back, because you're just hanging by your safety belt. There's no, you're in an open cockpit.
What kind of things did they make you do when you're training? Did they tell you to stall that thing out?
Oh, yes. The training was very, very good and very intense, and you were exposed to all sorts of emergency procedures of engines quitting and stalling out and how to recover from them. The biggest thing I had to get over at first was was air sickness.
Yeah. I imagine it was. Yeah, the first time that you could, thank you, Connie. Got a note here on a question I have to ask you. Okay, the first time that you went up and soloed, you said that was something that you'd never forget. Did they give you advance warning?
I think it's worse than talking on the radio.
Is that right? Nothing's worse than that. Did they give you advance warning so you could worry about it for a long time?
Oh, sure. They figured if you didn't learn to solo in 6 or 7 hours, you weren't worth fooling with, and they'd wash out a substantial number of the class. And this, there it is. Go do it.
I've been reading a book called Fate is the Hunter. Forgot the author's name. Same guy that wrote The High and the Mighty. But he's talking about this period in aviation. He actually started, I think, in the 30s, and talked about the undergoing training for new aircraft or whatever. And you see the same thing in the movies. The instructors are portrayed as guys that looked at you with steely eyes, made you feel like you were the dumbest people in the world and you weren't going to make it anyway, but they were going to do their best to keep you in the air. Did you get that kind of attitude?
Yes, I think we forget now, since been so long since we've had that exposure of the type of discipline that you were subjected to, and not only that, and you were expected to respond to. Mm-hmm. It had a lot to do with the building of the character of the American Army and Navy and Air Force. It was the discipline that I was subjected to was very positive, very positive. Mm.
Okay, that first flight, you walked out there, you get in the thing alone, and you've had maybe 6 or 7 total hours flying time to that point, right?
You bounced and wobbled a lot as you took off.
Is that right?
Right.
When they started the engine, did you have an electric start on it? Or did they
you'd usually start it yourself or somebody else. You'd have to step out and turn the propeller and put your foot on the wheel like you used to see in the movies and run around and jump in the cockpit.
Is that right? Did you have a big crowd watching you, all the other trainees and all that stuff? Or?
No, you had a few critical people like your instructor who was frowning and glowering.
It was a big enough crowd himself, I suppose.
Right.
What was the thing that you were the most apprehensive about when you had to make that first flight?
Landing. Always landing. Mm-hmm. Although you look back at it now, those planes they're as safe as an old flivver. They'd land at 40, 50, 60 miles an hour. The wheelbase was very narrow, and they were easy to kind of cartwheel. Mm-hmm. But thousands of boys did it. You know, we built quarter of a million airplanes during World War II. A quarter of a million airplanes.
Yeah, I've read that.
Think how many pilots that.
Yeah, because a lot of those airplanes, as I understand it, it wasn't just that pilot and that crew with that aircraft. There were times when you had a couple of crews working the same aircraft. Land it, refuel it, and somebody else go fly it somewhere else.
That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Usually, though, when you're overseas, you had your own airplane. You really got an identity with it. It was kind of like your own horse.
Did you name your plane when you were flying in the Aleutians?
Oh, we did. But that's all kind of corny, really, when I look back at it. I don't even remember what it was.
Yeah.
Well, I really think, Scott, it's fun to talk about where we've been. I think that you and I really, those things are important. We probably really should be a lot more interested in where we're going and where we've been. I just think there's some wonderful opportunities in the Chelan Valley for the young people coming along in properties. I just think we're going to hit another plateau here, as ridiculous as property values may seem now. We'll probably go along at this level, and they'll explode again. If I were to encourage you or any of the others that are listening in, go mortgage your soul, buy something, because I think it's a great place to hide your money.
Yeah. That's been, historically, that has been the story of the growth of the Chelan community. A lot of its young people have left in each generation, but those who've stayed have usually done pretty well.
And, you know, yes, they have.
Made investments. Had a listener call in a question here. Let me see if I can read the note. Says a listener called and wondered if Dan would talk about the old canoe house below Campbell's. I guess that is that what that is? In the days of the pavilion and nightlife, and how much did they rent the canoes for?
We used to rent them for about 25 cents an hour, and that's when I first learned a little about business. Found out it was well to get a little deposit on the canoe for a dollar or two, or else you'd find it left up the lake a half a mile. We had the canvas canoes with the cedar insides, and there was a lot of repair work to do on them. people would beach them and walk on them and break the ribs, and it was a good experience for a young man.
Well, what period of time was this when you were renting the canoes?
I've forgotten about that. That was right in the heart of the Depression in the early 30s.
That's why you're familiar with the repair work, because as one of the boys of the family, I suppose it was
that's
one of your
right.
jobs.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about nightlife? We talked about the Harlem Globetrotters, but they obviously weren't in town every night. Was there much nightlife for a young fellow in high school in the late 30s?
I think a great deal of our social life oriented around school. They would have regular weekend dances in the gym. And it was a great place to see your friends and to socialize. And it was, particularly in the winter with the basketball games, it was a highlight of something to do.
Yeah.
We didn't go to an Natchez very often. And everybody got home early, or your mother would be standing on the porch.
Mm-hmm. What about the summertime? What did you youngsters do in the summertime when school
was? Oh, it was all lake oriented. And all the young people did the same. During our early years, you'd put your swimming suit on when you got up in the morning and take it off when you went to bed at night and probably wear out 3 swimming suits during the summer.
Yeah. I've heard stories, and maybe this was before the lake was raised, but I've heard stories of some of the people who came here as tourists standing on docks or perhaps on the bridge and tossing coins into the water and having the youngsters dive for them. Do you remember anything about that?
Everybody used to dive off the bridge, and they still do. Just something that young people like to do.
Yeah. What about the dock that the docking facilities that you had at the resort? Not too long ago, there was the dock there that the lady used to dock at. But were there others before that? Do you remember?
That dock had been built and rebuilt and renovated for so many years. I really would like to see the city build another dock down there, if for no other reason, just for people to promenade on and for the young people to fish off of. I know that it wouldn't be suitable for the big lady boat to come down anymore and turn around, and with the probable parking congestion that it would create, but it was a social thing to have a nice city dock that people just used.
Yeah. You were mentioning earlier the opportunities for young people, and I wonder if you could go back to maybe your late days in high school, or maybe after World War II when you came home. What kind of thinking was going on in the generation of your father, and advice to your generation about whether or not to stay here in Lake Chelan or to go and seek out a new fortune elsewhere in the world? What kind of
very positive. I remember father saying, look at property values. He would say, as atrocious as the price may be on a parcel of property, sooner or later somebody's going to buy it, and they do, and then they're going to sell it for more. And I think the same opportunities are here for people who like the valley. It was kind of interesting, the trip I took this winter through Palm Springs and over to Scottsdale, to see the activity and the wealth, depth of people that are, for good or for bad, are going to come this way. We have the power here, we have the serenity of an agricultural valley, we have our lovely lake. It's just coming. Scott, you might as well get ready for it.
Whether you want the influx or not.
Whether you want it or not, and we should prepare for it and do it right.
Dan, I really want to thank you for coming. I've immensely enjoyed this, and I was amazed that the time went so rapidly. Thank you very much for coming.
You're sure welcome, Scott.
We've been talking with Dan Campbell this morning, live at the Crockery. And before you get away, I got a couple things I want to mention to you, Dan, too. But at any rate, tomorrow, again, we'll be looking at some of the old Lindsley photographs from days gone by, going way back, and some fascinating photographs of the city of Chelan and the lake itself. We've got lots of interesting people coming up this week. And at any time, this week. If you want to stop in and sit down at the crockery, listen in on the conversation, maybe even join in on it, you're welcome to do so. But for today, that's about it, Steve.